Welcome to the Intertidal Talks podcast. I am Kendra, marine biologist and your host. This podcast is meant to teach, inform, and entertain you about all things marine science and conservation. If you are a marine scientist or advocate with a story to share, you can contact me at intertidaltalks@gmail.com. Want to join our marine science community? Join us at patreon.com/kendi_marinebio. Hello and welcome back to Intertidal Talks. I am super excited for today's episode because this is someone I've wanted to talk to for a long time. I've talked to him online, but we are with Jordan Lerma. And so, Jordan, why don't you introduce yourself with your name and pronouns?
Hi, thank you so much for allowing me to come onto this podcast and talk about myself. My name is Jordan Lerma. My pronouns, he, him, that person.
Perfect. And like, what do you do? What's like a little intro, like mini life story to like set us up for what we'll talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. I work for Cascadia Research Collective. I am a native Hawaiian, born and raised in Hawaii, was surrounded by water, but never really was interested in it until I moved to California, and being deprived of the warm tropical waters of Hawaii makes you really appreciate stuff. So got involved in marine conservation kind of backwards, but I'm currently involved in a research project going on 21 years, and really excited to bring in a different perspective to marine science.
Which island did you grow up on?
I'm born and raised in Hilo on the Big Island.
Okay. That's beautiful. I loved going to Big Island. So what's like your education background?
Yeah. Like I said, I came into marine science a little backwards. I studied transport economics and public finance. And okay. I worked at an investment bank for a year and realized it really wasn't what I wanted to do. My education, I was really, really, really passionate about transportation. I studied specifically how parking and free parking affected people's behavior. But you know, studied economics because I'm kind of fascinated by the measurement side of human behavior. Mm-hmm. And all of the little small moving pieces that, you know, need to happen to affect large scale change. So you know, that's kind of my mentality coming into the field. You know, we all agree on certain things, like, you know, the price of goods and services should reflect the environmental impacts they have. But yeah. It's a question of how do you get to that point. But, you know, I study economics to try and understand what I cared about. And in a measurable way, how do I create a better world for the future generations?
Yeah, so that's super interesting. Like, how you went from that then to marine science. Cause I always tell people, I'm like, there's no right way to do it. There's no perfect timeline. So from then, how did you get involved with Cascadia? Did you start immediately with them, or was it like,
embarrassingly enough, I had no idea Cascadia existed until Robin Baird, my boss's book came out. Mm-hmm. And up until the book came out, I really had no idea of all of the species that existed around Hawaii. And, you know, born and raised on the Big Island, and thought that humpback whales, bottlenose dolphins, and spinner dolphins were the only things around, that killer whales were only in where it's cold, just ignorant. And you know, I'm not embarrassed to say it now, but, you know, I really wish there was a better education system for these types of things in Hawaii. And one of the goals that I have is to try and increase the knowledge for students, like much like what you do.
Yeah.
But I got into the field. I got to working with Cascadia basically through flying drones. I quit my job in San Francisco and moved to the island of Kauai. And there I lived in Hanapepe, where the internet and power would go out if it was windy. It was like the exact opposite of San Francisco.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. I mean, I didn't work. I lived off savings and I just did whatever I wanted to do. I called it like my early retirement. Like mm-hmm. I wanted to see what retirement was like while I was still in my 20s. So I really just followed my interest of the day. And one day I was like, wow, drones are cool. I'm going to buy one. So I blew like half my savings buying this drone and it just coincided with whale season. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, really, there's some people flying over whales with drones at the time, but it was really, really bad quality.
Yeah.
Like the movements, it was just like, I wanted to throw up and I'd get motion sickness trying to watch the footage. I was like, I think I can do it better. And I really just started doing that. And each day was like, oh, I got a humpback breathing. Like no one's seen that before. That's really cool. And then one day it was like humpbacks and spinner dolphins. And then it was humpbacks and bottlenose dolphins. And it's just like one thing led to the next. And I was like, oh, I'm so addicted to getting new experiences to share with people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I met Robin at Whale Tales, a humpback whale conference in Maui. And I told him like, hey, I fly drones. Are you guys using drones in your research? And coincidentally, it was something he just added to his permit, but had no one to fly.
Oh.
He didn't know anyone who flew drones, but recognized that it was something that's where research was headed.
Yeah.
That's going to be a good method in order to study whales and dolphins at some point. And really, I pitched him that and he said, all right, maybe you can come out for a day and just volunteer. And really, I didn't fly any drones for Cascadia for the first year I volunteered.
Mm-hmm.
And I would come out and go on the boat. And for me, I mean, I didn't spend much time on boats. Like I wasn't a water person.
Just thrown into
it. So I'm like pretending to know how to tie a line and tied it completely wrong on the cleat. And I mean, it was like a complete learning experience for me. But in a way, I think it's beneficial to have that knowledge of nothing where yeah. where Robin or anyone on the boat can teach you the right way to do things.
Yeah.
And I think that's what my case was. They were able to mold me to perform the tasks the way they wanted to without a bad habit.
Yeah. Well, I feel like being thrown into it and just yeah. not being told what to do kind of helps learn on your feet.
I mean, a lot of YouTube that. And Google.
I've definitely had to do that with some different tools we've used in labs where I'm just like, yeah, I know how to do this. And I'm like quickly Googling before we get there, like, what is this? And like the tying, I'll be like, yeah, I could tie up my grandma's boat and that's about it. But, and that's definitely not as like important. Like, yeah, that's so funny. So basically photography is kind of how you got.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm passionate about taking photos and sharing photos with people and getting people's reactions and getting people interested in stuff through photography. And, you know, thankfully it led me to the field.
Yeah. And your photography is beautiful. I love your page. Oh my goodness. So, so you met Robin at Whale Tales, and so he's with Cascadia. So like what is Cascadia, to like explain it to listeners who may not have heard of Cascadia?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly didn't hear of Cascadia, although they've been doing a lot of work and, you know, recently have been doing a lot of outreach. Mm-hmm. So Cascadia is a nonprofit, 501c3, that's been doing scientific research and education since 1979. They've done a variety of different things, ranging from working with bats to marine mammals.
The bats in Hawaii?
No, bats on the West Coast, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the office, Cascadia is kind of split into two separate projects. There's a West Coast project. And a Hawaii-based project. And I got started on the Hawaii project, but you know, there's some overlap now that mm-hmm. I live in Olympia, Washington.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Hawaii project was started by Robin in the early 2000s, I think in like February 2000. And initially got funded to do bottlenose research.
Mm-hmm.
And one of Robin's first encounters off of Kona, he ended up biopsying a beaked whale. And that led to more funding for different species. And it's now led to, you know, where we are today. And the Hawaii Project has a photo ID catalog of 14 species. I think we're over 1.3 million photos taken.
That's incredible.
thousands of unique individuals in various populations. We track population abundance. We put out satellite tags to look at movements, biopsies to look at health, drone breath sampling to look at respiratory microbiome. We take photos of mouth of animals' mouths to look for fisheries interactions. Mm-hmm. So a bunch of different work that kind of, you know, one thing leads to the next, and suddenly you're doing work for pretty much every marine mammal in Hawaii.
Yeah. So like, what would, when you're doing the field days in Hawaii, like what does your day to day look like when you're there?
Yeah. I think a lot of people see the glamorous side of, it's probably my fault for only posting bow riding dolphins all the time. Stop doing that.
I do that too.
Yeah. So we typically go into the field from anywhere from 8 to 20 days. It just depends on funding. Mm-hmm. We tend to work on the leeward side of the islands where effort can be a little bit more consistent in terms of weather. Mm-hmm. We start every day before sunrise and we head out looking for deep, calm water. And we have observers on every side of the boat. We're constantly scanning for anything that could possibly be an animal. And hopefully we encounter some species, and it's always random. And I think that's part of the reason why this work appeals to me is that any day we could see nothing. Mm-hmm. And I would be fully focused because it's just like that one splash that could lead to like a false killer whale encounter. Yeah. Or even seeing a new species of beaked whale. I mean, the possibilities are endless, and you never know what you're going to see. But on a typical day, you know, we'll go out and we'll work with whatever we find. And you know, the methods that we use for each species depend. One more consistent thing we've been doing lately is launching the drone to increase productivity with encounters. This has been especially useful for elusive species like beaked whales or dwarf sperm whales. Mm-hmm. We're able to increase our encounter durations by basically tracking animals with the drone. Which has been an interesting part. And then depending on funding, we'll either put out satellite tags, just take photos, or do photos and a biopsy. And it really just depends on what we see. And, you know, how long the day goes on depends on the species we're working with. If we're working with false killer whales or something high priority, it's going to be until there's no light left.
Yeah.
We'll be coming back to the harbor in the dark. Yeah. If it's a really high priority day. So, you know, it can end when the wind picks up or it can go on until we can't see the animals anymore.
It's like, what is like the coolest or maybe some of the coolest encounters? Yeah. I think one of my new favorite photos of yours is of the false killer whale, like catching that fish. I can't remember, yeah. But just such a cool shot and they're such cool animals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, working with each species, I mean, seeing the differences in species is certainly interesting. And false killer whales are awesome to watch them predate on mahi-mahi or ono. I get asked this a lot, like what's my favorite encounter? And it's such a difficult one because there's so many, and I'm privileged to be able to say that there's so many to choose from. But I usually answer with the most meaningful encounter to me, and that was with a sperm whale off of Kauai. And I'm not sure if it's because they're revered in Hawaiian culture. Mm-hmm. And that was in the back of my mind when that encounter happened, but really it brought me to tears and it really didn't do anything. It took a couple of breaths and dove. And mm-hmm. it wasn't as exciting as watching false killer whales predate on mahi or bow riding bottlenose dolphins, but really it was a short encounter and it was just left me completely in tears.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, right before we moved off Oahu, me and my husband went to the Bishop Museum because we'd never gone. We always wanted to go. And it was like the week there's like that big sperm whale pod, I think, on Big Island. And I was like, what if we, and it had the sperm whale there and it talks a little bit about the different ties with all these different marine animals into Hawaiian culture. So I don't know if you do want to share about that. I do really appreciate too, like, some input from Native Hawaiian Kanaka. I think it's really important in tying everything back into the island. And I feel like that does get overlooked a lot with a lot of universities. I know I think one of my favorite things I did in the field was on Maui. We went and were doing invasive plant. We were like basically destroying these invasive weeds. But before we went in, we, I forget what it's called. I want to say ikimai, but I don't think that's it, where you like give a chant, basically asking or kind of saying your respect and asking permission to go forward. And then our guide like called back and like gave us the permission. And I thought that was really cool and a great way to show reverence.
Yeah.
But also we're working, because we're working on incredible land that is very, and the people are very tied to it. And it really like humbled me as like a researcher, a scientist, to where we're working. It isn't all just land that I'm just so excited to explore. Like there are such important areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I went to Kamehameha Schools, where that protocol was our day to day. Every morning we started chanting to our kumu, our teachers, and they would chant back to give us permission to come in and learn. And I take that with me. I mean, I chant either internally or if I'm standing on the bow by myself, you know, I ask for the permission to come into their home to study them because it's
that's amazing.
Even growing up in Hawaii, you know, we feel a little bit more privileged to say, hey, I'm Hawaiian, but really, like you said, it's not ours, you know, and in any way you can to show reverence and intent for why you're out there. You know, we are taking from them.
Yeah.
So how are we gonna, what in what ways are we gonna give it back and help the animals? And that's kind of what I think about when I'm giving my oli in the morning. And it's really beautiful when it's just me on the bow and I'm thinking about this stuff and the sun's rising over Mauna Kea. And it's just like, oh, this is perfect. this is beautiful. But yeah, I mean, I truly hope people doing research in Hawaii or anywhere where there's other indigenous cultures, that they are aware that, you know, these types of things exist, and we all are foreigners. We all are outsiders, and keeping the animals in our hearts and our best interests is important, but also keeping in mind that there's more at risk if we don't.
And so we talked about, so Cascadia does a lot in Hawaii. I had a super cool experience. I saw those bottlenose off of Kona, and then I was able to submit some of the photos and actually get IDs back for one of them. And then another, they said wasn't in the program yet with like, a name or whatever, but they've seen photos of her, which I thought was super cool. And you encourage people to do that if anyone ever goes. Oh,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's the one of the main mechanisms that we use to understand the populations that exist around Hawaii. And, you know, shout out to the office staff, you know, Sabra and Annette and Alex, it's amazing. They can see a fin and be like, oh, that's like HITT037. Like, what? What are you talking
Dolphin.
About? Yeah. I mean, really, when we're on the boat working with animals, if we have a question of what animal we're working with, I can take a screenshot. I can take a photo from my phone of the camera's screen and text it to Sabra, and she'll be like, within a minute or two, be like, this is the animal, it's been tagged, it's been biopsied, it's a male. Cool. It's like, oh my gosh, it's truly, they're really good at their jobs. Mm-hmm. And that information is so valuable in understanding these species. And it, you know, one thing that gets kind of overlooked is how much more we have to learn and how much more is needed in order to fully recognize what species are resident or not in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, bottlenose dolphins, there's one stock in Hawaii, but we're, you know, through photo ID showing that there's high rates of residency per island. You know, Maui Nui has its own population, Oahu and Kauai have their own populations, and Big Island has their own populations. So each risk that each population faces differs based on where they are geographically.
Yeah.
Not just lumping them all into, oh, they're all in Hawaii, so, you know, management's all the same. So that's why I ask people to submit photos, because really we are out there, you know, three or four projects a year, but some folks are out there every day. And the more data we get, the better decisions we can make for better management.
Yeah. And I love like the citizen science aspect, like as a tourist, which is what I was doing when I was in Kona, with our experience that I felt so cool that I was able to just submit photos and be like, oh, I know now who this one dolphin is, which makes it for me more important because I love ID programs. Like the One Ocean has the ID program that I kind of learned with the sharks, but then the Southern Residents, I'm learning those right now and all the different populations out here that I think it's really, really cool and a fun way to like address an animal. And to know more about, like, is it a resident population or is it a passing dolphin? Do we know much about it? At some point you could even trace like, oh, this dolphin had a calf with her. That means how many calves has she mothered and whatnot. I think it's awesome. And that citizens can get involved. Like we are we all have a part to play even just on vacation.
Yeah. I mean, it breaks down that barrier between what people think of scientists too, right? Mm-hmm. It's like if you're able to submit a photo that contributes to this understanding, it's just like, well, I'm a scientist too now.
Yeah.
And really there's that barrier that exists currently with thinking of these scientists as this different population of people. It's just like, we're all in it together. I mean, we're all trying to figure it out.
Yeah. And what the scientists do is helping everyone. It's not like it's just for us. Like knowing about that dolphin population doesn't just help me. It helps others because it can impact like a fishery happening and all that other stuff, like what's happening in that environment that impacts tourists and whatnot. Yeah. So Cascadia does great work in Hawaii, but they also do work up here in the PNW. So what kind of work is Cascadia doing up here?
Yeah, our West Coast office mostly works with gray whales and humpbacks. Mm-hmm. There's the sounders, the few individuals of gray whales that feed in the sound. So John Kalmakidis, who is one of the founders of Cascadia and mostly heads up that type of research, will go out and biopsy and get photos of gray whales. They're also active up and down the West Coast, down to California and even into Baja, doing work with blue whales and fin whales, doing tagging work in response to mitigate ship strikes and that kind of stuff. More recently, one thing I forgot to mention about Robin, before going into starting the Hawaii project, he was actively involved in killer whale work. His PhD thesis, I need to remember this, is on the foraging behavior and ecology of transient killer whales. And he worked with Michael Big.
Wow.
A lot of field work for Michael Big.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, he I think a lot of what he was doing still is, a foundation for the research being done there today.
Yeah.
He's not actively involved with any field work there, but he's, enabled me to go out. We've been doing drone breath sampling in Hawaii with false killer whales, pilot whales, and beaked whales. So that's something that's required for understanding the health of southern resident killer whales.
Yeah.
Since no tagging or biopsying, no invasive tagging or biopsying are allowed with that population at the moment. Finding non-invasive ways to better understand their health is super important. So in 2019, we were able to go up and kind of start that research. And, I got to spend 2 weeks or 3 weeks up there with Brad Hansen and the folks at NOAA, but also had, the head vet from SeaWorld there to look at his assessment of the health of the animals. We were working with SeaDoc. They're part of UC Davis's research lab that's up there with Joe Gatos. So it was an awesome experience because I like working with animals, but I'm super interested in how do we use technology to better understand their health and their well-being.
Yeah.
And everyone wants to work with killer whales. I mean, that's
charismatic megafauna.
Yeah, like I mean,
kingpin, basically.
Yeah, and it's funny when I went up there, they almost don't want to work with people like that because it's like they're just a distraction on the boat. Like the first couple of days, a research assistant is just useless because they're just so in awe of being around the animals.
Me crying on the boat, like where my first time seeing. Like,
kill the whale. All right, let's get the drone up or something. Like, what do we got to do? So, like, I like that I got into this field not loving animals, but I'm concerned about answering a question about the animals.
Yeah.
It's an indirect love for the species. So not being distracted by killer whales although they can be very distracting at times. You know, we COVID really put a damper in things in 2020. We had two field projects get canceled with working with Southern residents.
COVID.
Probably for the better. I mean, you know, safety of the crew. But missing out on a year of health assessment data.
Two new babies.
Yeah, I mean, the NOAA team was still able to go out, and they got a tag out, a suction cup tag out. So, you know, there's still data coming in, but really I was so, my interest is using drones to understand their health and develop methods to kind of facilitate that in a better way. So hopefully 2021 is a little bit better with people getting vaccines and wearing masks.
Yes.
And hopefully we get up there and are able to do some work with the Southern residents.
Yeah. So, well, a couple things to note on that. I know captivity is always a debate, but you mentioned the SeaWorld head vet. Yeah. So I think some people might not know that SeaWorld is really involved with some of the Southern resident work. And was that around the time where the debate with capturing Scarlet was going on? Because I know they kind of got brought in.
So my field work was after that.
Okay.
But so
they were involved after.
The two vets, Joe Gatos, I think were involved in that process of figuring out what they should do.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy, but those SeaWorld vets, like SeaWorld has a lot to contribute with killer whales.
Absolutely.
You can argue to the extents, but they are, those two vets are professionals. And I would say some top of the field. And so I think it's really great that they're involved in research.
You know, I was really, really impressed with both Joe Gatos and Hendrik Nolens. I mean, they are very, very smart people.
Yeah.
And of course they care about the animals, and captivity is a tough subject in general, but really they're there as vets, as professionals to study the health of these animals.
We're not out there debating each other on the boats.
It's a tough issue. And really, I mean, I think it's separate from what their main concern is. What can we do now to better understand and make management decisions for these animals?
Yeah.
And controversy aside, I think their hearts are in the right place, and they're there, and they're using resources to try and answer these questions for the betterment of the species. So it's a tough issue. It's a tough issue for sure.
But it's so great to see people working together.
Yeah.
Obviously we all have differing opinions on the whole situation, but when it comes down to it, we want to protect these species, and we'll take the professionals and the researchers that can help. So Cascadia has worked with the Southern residents. Obviously the Southern residents are a big topic.
Yeah. I mean, Cascadia, Robin tends Robin avoids working with them, I think, for the controversial reasons.
Yeah.
Not to say that it's not important to do it. I just think there's the same reason why we don't work with humpbacks in Hawaii. I just think there's a lot of parties already doing the research, and there's no sense in wasting money to do stuff that other people are doing already.
Yeah, and oversaturating.
But with that being said, the drone breath sampling stuff is something that we really pioneered with the small, medium-sized species. Mm-hmm. And I think applying that to a population like the Southern residents is going to be super beneficial in understanding.
A non-invasive way to get an understanding of their health.
We can keep the boat as far back as we want.
Yeah.
And still be able to monitor.
Because that's become
drone.
A controversy about pursuing them because of the stress. Yeah. I know that's someone sent me a petition at one point, I want to say like 6 months ago, when the Navy stuff was going down, to have me advertise and sign to like ban companies or researchers from getting close to any killer whales, but it was focused on the Southern residents because it was damaging them. But I was, as a researcher and a scientist, I'm like, I don't know, because like there are reasons that these scientific boats need to get closer to these whales than say like a whale watching vessel.
Yeah.
To the point where is the stress that they're going to get before maybe deploying the non-invasive suction cup tags worth the data that we're going to get for the hour or so that tag is on? Yeah. How quickly can they bounce back from the behavior, obviously their stress behavior from being close to the boat to being like, okay, the boat's gone, I feel better. And going back to the normal behavior to get all that data. So it's something controversial, which is why droning is awesome and something that should continue to be explored and used.
Yeah. I mean, There are trade-offs to any research method, and there's definitely limitations to what we were able to accomplish with the drone. You know, it's a lot different working in the Pacific Northwest versus Hawaii. Like, I can't see a Southern Resin underwater more than 6 or 10 meters, where in Hawaii, I mean, I can see down pretty far.
Yeah.
You know, at least being able to track animals. So there are limitations to non-invasive methods. And, you know, it's a tough one with any species because, you know, what do you expect to gain versus what's the cost?
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to. And what I like about how research boats operate in Hawaii and the Pacific Northwest is that we use data sheets. You know, we document every interaction that we have with these animals. We document approach distances. We have laser rangefinders and we rangefind animals to write down on those data sheets how close we got.
Mm-hmm.
And we write down reactions and we note all of these things. And the people on the permits are required to summarize these reports and submit them so that, you know, when situations arise like the Southern residents, they can justify why certain research actions need to have close approaches or deploy suction cup tags. I mean, there's a lot of reporting that people aren't aware of regarding some of these methods that really are a checks and balances, a way to make sure that what the cost associated with what we're doing is justified.
Yeah.
And that's a tough one because most people don't see that. They just see the animals, the bad side, you know, the reactions from animals, not so much the things we hope to learn.
Yeah. And I more so know about tagging with sharks because mm-hmm. I have more experience with sharks, but I've talked to people, shark researchers, and they'll say like tagging, we've learned a lot from tagging sharks, and sharks, you're allowed to do like the invasive tags where you're drilling through their dorsals mm-hmm. to anchor on a tag. And that's like a long-term tag. And then there are spaghetti tags and all that, but there is like a lot of controversy. They'll tell me about arguments they've gotten into with people who are not in research, that it's not worth it. It hurts the animal. Like it's not. And like, sometimes sharks will die on the line if you're not quick enough to pull one up, to deploy a tag. And that's where it is kind of, I think it's important to find non-invasive ways, but also to inform on the data we are getting from quote unquote invasive, even semi-invasive tags. Some people would say any kind of tagging is invasive, but
yeah, no, it certainly is invasive. There's no doubt that is invasive, but I think there's enough.
The payoff.
People have tagged enough to have learned what the right way to do it is.
Yeah.
You know, we know what we expect to get back from the tags, and it's a matter of following the agreed upon methods to make sure that we're doing it in the most humane way possible to reduce the amount of potential risk to the animal.
And we're constantly learning ways to not be invasive. I know in Hawaii, there's a study about how you can take water samples to get some like DNA fragments of sharks. We don't have to go out and physically tag them, but just find areas where we can take water samples to get an understanding of what species are in the area, which is awesome because that would like deplete a lot of the tagging that's going on. And tagging can kill sharks. It's killed, like, I have friends who've gone out and they've talked about how sometimes a baby tiger or baby, like a younger shark, will be caught in the line and not get noticed. And before they can get to it, it's already been stressed and damaged that it doesn't make it.
Yeah.
And that's sad, but it's one of those things, like it pushes for more innovation, like the drones these different forms, which I think is awesome. Science is constantly evolving and we're getting better.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly was skeptical when I first was introduced to tagging. I mean, it is odd to have a air rifle on the boat, right? Like, it's like, what are we doing? But after, I mean, we have really high reciting rates of tagged animals that are completely healed. And even watching the reactions, like most animals react to being tagged, but, you know, go back to pre-tagging behavior in less than like 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
It's like bow riding, get tagged, go off, come back, bow ride again. It's just like, it's a tough thing to communicate to people because all they see is the effort of tagging.
Yeah. And they're obviously so passionate about these animals. They don't want any other kind. And that's the thing, that's where like you bridge the gap. We all love the animals.
Yeah.
Obviously.
But I mean, for tagging specifically, you know, we we on our data sheets, we write down what the start behavior of the encounter was. What was the animal doing before it got tagged? How did it react to tagging? And what did it do post tagging?
Yeah.
We record durations for most of these things. You know, it's not like we just go out and put out tags on whatever animal we want. You know, we specifically target animals.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we know what information we need to get. And we're not gonna risk an animal's well-being because we wanna just get tags out.
Yeah.
You know, there are certainly benefits that are part of the conversation.
I love that. I think tags are super cool. I think the suction tags that are used in a lot of cetacean species are really cool and a great less invasive way of tagging an animal. I know, at least I don't know if you've heard of this too, but at some point there was a tag on a killer whale in the Northwest that was like sawed through the dorsal, but that ended up dying of an infection, which is why we don't do any form of invasive tags like that anymore on killer whales.
Yeah.
We've learned from the mistake.
I mean, I wasn't there, but I am aware of that. And you know, like I said before, you know, in developing methods to minimize the risk to populations, I don't want to speak too much about it because I personally wasn't there. But
yeah.
The report from NOAA is public and it is online with the necropsy results.
Yeah, well, so it's like I know the scarlet debate was a big thing. Is it worth the, the danger of catching her, that if we can help her gain back some body weight and further do medication? But it was a huge debate on if just catching in of itself is ethical. Would she die in the process? How will the family react?
Yeah.
That there's always like, you do have to weigh those pros and cons of trying to help a species, especially the critically endangered like southern residents that we have right now.
Yeah.
That is a constant debate. And people will ask me like, what if we just caught them all and had them breed and just like fed them? I'm like, well, we can't just catch up. There's like 74 of them still, like, and it'd be such a huge debate and process to even get to that point. And there would be pros and cons. Like, we don't know how that would even work. And if it'd be worth it in the long run. And with Scarlet, would it have even been worth it? Would she have even lasted more than a day? We saw that. One great example is with like the vaquita in, what sea is that? Oh my gosh. Wherever the vaquita are, I can't remember, but
Cortez, is that where they are?
Yeah. Yeah. There's the Sea of Shadows and they show the footage of them catching there's like a adult female that literally died within, I think, 24 hours just because the stress of capture. So you never know if that's just going to happen depending on the species, but I think it was worth to try, because what if she had survived? We would have known, let's go catch more vaquita and bring them in.
With the vaquita example, I mean, you had the world's best marine scientists and vets making those decisions and doing everything they can. And that goes to show that even with the right decisions and trying to do the right thing, some species, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You don't really know that until, like you said, until you try.
Yep. And I think it's a good thing we tried. It's sad that she did die and it was a female, obviously, like that hurt the population, but in the, like, there's always the, what if she had lived? That's what, it's a huge thing. And now we're learning from the vaquita extinction.
Yeah.
What we can do better to help species that are going to be reaching a state like them. Always learning.
I hope it certainly sets an example for the importance of science-based policy. I mean, it's sad to see species go extinct for sure, but I think it's more sad knowing that there's other species out there that are going extinct, just not on that scale yet that we aren't doing anything about.
We can still do something.
Yeah. Or there's so much disagreement about what the right things are, despite an overwhelming amount of facts.
Yeah.
That we refuse to. Yeah. It's a tough issue. I mean, that goes back to economics, right? It's like the study of human behavior through how we use resources. And it's just like, it's so interesting. How do you see people's motivations?
Yeah. Everything ties in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's humans are very complex.
Yes. That's very true.
Yeah.
And so lastly, a big part of this podcast is that I want like aspiring marine scientists of any degree to specifically take tips away, especially from my guests.
Yeah.
Especially with you, you have such like a different background. I feel like most people are coming from like a degree in like biology and coming into it. But what would a tip that you would give to either a student or just someone who wants to work in this field that even maybe doesn't have a background in it, like no experience just getting into it?
Well, first off, I'll say people that are studying and listening to this, that are studying marine biology, I'm very jealous because I wish I did. You know, I am catching up to a lot of the science background that I need to be able to do my job. And having that, knowing that you wanted to do that from an early age is something I never had. So I'm jealous. I can never get that time back. But two, for people that don't have that background, I think I'm an example that it's possible to get into this field. Google and YouTube are great resources. And really, if there's one tip, if I have to break it down to one tip, start birding. Really, like birding is a great, great skill. And most of the scientists, most of the marine scientists I've been on the boat with are birders. And it's because birding helps you look for very, very minute differences. It helps your observational skills a lot. And how do you describe a bird to someone else is very difficult. How do you describe where a bird is physically in geographical space to someone else? So if you're able to be able to communicate those types of information with birds, those skills translate over to whales so easily. One other plug, if you Google Robin Baird advice, the first link that shows up on Google is a page that he put up to help people that want to get into this field. And it's a resource that I've used from the first day that I've met him on the boat. I asked him, how do I get into this field with no background? He's like, go look at my website. I'm like, all right. And I refer to that website maybe about once a month because you always have to keep learning. Yeah. And yeah, it's a great resource. I would say start there. And if you look under Cascadia's list of biologists, there's another employee here, Michaela Cratophil. If you go to her website, I'm not sure if it's linked on Cascadia's page or not, but it's michaela-cratophil.com. She has a very good resource list with coding resources, getting into ecological statistics, especially for beginners, for people that might be put off by coding. That's a great other alternative to get into the field.
And I'll link all that in the description of this too.
Yeah.
How are ways people can find you and anything else you maybe want to plug?
Yeah. Really follow Cascadia on Instagram at Cascadia Research. We're on Twitter at Cascadia Res, R-E-Z, R-E-S. I think it's R-E-S. Yeah. R-E-S, Cascadia Res. I'm Uheu on Instagram, U-H-E-H-E-U. I've kind of been more quiet on social media lately, but definitely need for a lot of outreach for this type of work. So
definitely worth the follow. Your photography and content's amazing, and advocacy really and everything.
Well, like I said, I'm learning every day, and I hope to be able to inspire more people to get into this field because we need inclusion and diversity. It's a necessity.
Yes. And is there any way maybe post-COVID people could get involved with Cascadia?
Yeah, absolutely. You can send me or Robin an email. We, depending on how the vaccine rollout goes and we start doing research projects again, we do take on 1 to 2 volunteers per day. And you know, that's how I got started. And it's really about showing people. It's taking people on the boat and showing them what we do, because words and photos and video only go so far. Really understanding the research is coming out on the boat with us. So the opportunity will hopefully exist post-COVID.
Hopefully.
We'll see how it goes, but our intention is to make this as transparent and widely available to people as possible.
Yes. And if people go to Kona or Hawaii and see a dolphin to send in, I'll do that link as well. Because I just thought that was super cool. And I know a lot of people travel to Hawaii.
And going out on tours. Photos, non-humpback or spinner dolphin photos from Hawaii can be sent to hawaii@cascadiaresearch.com or cascadiaresearch.org, hawaii@cascadiaresearch.org. And even photos of blue whales, fin whales, humpbacks, gray whales up and down the West Coast can also be submitted. to Cascadia Research. So really appreciate the citizen scientists out there, and hopefully more coming soon.
Yes, perfect. Well, thank you so much for... And we will talk again on our next episode.